Now, I don't know whether you do read the Financial Times or not. It's full of economic technicalities, mostly worried about Lehman Bank and so on, full of economic gloom. I guess my parents would probably have abandoned the technicalities and looked at today's situation and probably come out with that sort of phrase of parents of their generation, about eyes being too big for your stomach. I don't know if your parents said that to you. When you'd helped yourself to rather too much food and couldn't finish it. Your eyes are too big for your stomach. Because some of it at least has to go down, doesn't it, to the kind of greed that's borrowed too much and the greed that's lent too much. Of course, these things are never as simple as lines like that. That's part of it. There's also this sense, isn't there, of everyone looking and saying, not worth it. And we've all been there. You remember the film you went to see? What was it like? Oh, it's not worth it. And if you went at Central London prices, then that's a bit of a blow. The bargain you thought you got, and then you got it home and realised it's not quite the bargain you'd hoped for. It gets a bit worse when it's the holiday you've been on, but we've probably all had one in the memory. And come back, hey, did you have a great time? It wasn't worth it. And don't ask me anymore. Now, when it becomes the car that wasn't worth it, it's more serious still. And when it's the home, that's where we are today, isn't it? Not worth that price anymore. We've all been there, and most of the time we can laugh about it now. But when you add words like subprime and credit crunch, then suddenly it becomes very painful and costly. And it affects everyone. I read this yesterday. It's the surest sign yet that Hollywood is feeling the credit crunch. Some of Tinseltown's biggest stars are mothballing their private jets. In recent weeks, Reese Witherspoon, Dustin Hoffman and Al Pacino have all been spotted on commercial airlines. So if you're due to make a trip recently, have a look as to who's sitting next to you. Hip-hop star Sean P. Diddy Combs was also there, and amongst the things he said was this, and I quote, he gave a shout to all my Saudi Arabian brothers and sisters and all my brothers and sisters from all the countries that have oil. If you could all please send me some oil for my jet, I would truly appreciate it. Now, don't shed too many tears for Hollywood. Save the tears for those struggling to find a home or keep a home. Those seeing jobs and savings going down the drain. The head of Nationwide interviewed after the US government bailed out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac the other day, said nothing governments could do would change the situation until the markets had adjusted properly. And that's when he predicted an overall 25% downturn in property prices. Everyone, he's suggesting, needs to look at their sons again. Strange, isn't it, to pick up a book that's a couple of thousand years old and find someone warning about just those dangers. But I don't know what you made of that passage we've just had read to us. But as I looked at it, the first lesson that I picked up was this, simply the importance of getting your sums right. The importance of getting your sums right. Now, of course, people have been swept along with the crowd in recent years, swept on a tide of unreality, especially where the property market's been concerned. Borrowers and lenders alike not doing their sums properly. And I'm struck when I read the Gospels by how stern Jesus is when he's faced with crowds. Do you notice? That's the situation here. You see how it begins in verse 25? Large crowds were travelling with Jesus. Now, crowds and religion are a recipe for danger. And you don't need cynical journalists or atheists to warn you of that. Jesus sees it crystal clearly, and his sternest warnings are for the crowds and for people who might just be swept along by crowds. I have to laugh, to be honest, when I hear people lecture about the dangers of mass emotionalism and being swept unthinkingly into religious faith and dismissing Christianity because of it. I wonder if they've ever looked at what Christ said. But then I look at some of the wreckage strewn alongside the Christian road. People who did rush thoughtlessly in and have collapsed, burnt out and off course. And I don't laugh. I weep at the damage and the hurt that's caused. It's why Jesus could not say more clearly to us, get your sums right. And when it comes to him, you see, we're not investing pennies. We're not even just investing pounds. It's all or nothing. So sit down and check the investment is worth it. I mean, any businessman or woman would do the same before sinking capital into a project. Will the returns be worth the investment? Well, don't treat Christ any differently. Don't turn your back on him without doing your sums. And don't rush to follow him without doing your sums. Just like the economic world, this lunchtime, let's have a reality check. There are only two questions I think we need to ask, and I'll put them in front of you. Here's the first one. One, can you afford to sign up? Can you afford to sign up? Look at verse 28. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Will he not first sit down and estimate the cost to see if he has enough money to complete it? Pretty obvious, isn't it? Here is the start of any cost-benefit analysis. Have I got the money to do the job in the first place? And you may think it's blindingly obvious, but London has its fair share of building projects that didn't make it. And others like Wembley Stadium that only just seem to get there by the skin of their teeth. Now look how he goes on. For if he lays, verse 29, the foundation, and is not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule him, saying, the fellow began to build and wasn't able to finish. I mean, think of the embarrassment if we can't actually afford to build those Olympic venues. And I'm not sure anyone's that confident that the people sat down and worked out the sums to begin with terribly well. You want to be a Christian? Well, you do understand what it costs, don't you? You do realize, don't you, that Jesus overtakes all other loyalties. Even the ones of those who are nearest and dearest to us. That's what he's saying in verse 26. Look at it. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Now, that's pretty striking language from anyone, isn't it? But it's particularly striking on the lips of Jesus, because he's meant to be pro-family, isn't he? I mean, you rather look to Jesus to be standing up for family life and family values. Well, this is not Jesus tearing up the commandment, honour your father and mother. A hate here, it's a kind of Jewish way of talking, which means love less. It's about priorities. And whose is the highest? It's a reminder that Jesus is a higher priority, even than those so close to us. A reminder that tensions are to be expected when new life breaks into a family and one member starts developing different values and different goals and ambitions and attitudes, and you can't follow Jesus without developing those. We'd always been a happy family, but now things have changed. She's not the sister I used to know. She's changed, complained one brother angrily about his sister's involvement with Christ. Of course I've changed, his sister told me. Before I was always drunk. I mean, you'd think some changes would be welcome, but don't count on it. I know of one girl, she lost her virginity, she was into drugs by the age of 13, she converted to Christ, were her parents delighted? Not a bit, they burnt her Bible. Now, don't hear Jesus wrongly. This isn't an excuse to break out of a difficult marriage or to kick over the traces with parents. You come to Jesus and he'll say, honour your father and mother, love your husband, love your wife, but you come to Jesus. If you've ever had to say to someone, if you're going to follow Christ, it will at least for the time being cost you your family, you'll realize what a difficult thing that is to say. And how much harder to live. But many a person won't even come to Christ for fear of what mother, father, girlfriend, boyfriend, husband, wife will say or think. Others do and face the consequences. 16-year-old was converted and thrown out of home by his mother. And she said this, "If you're going to live here, you'll live by my rules. If you want to live by someone else's rules, then you go somewhere else." Of course, there'll be folk here this lunchtime. You're from Christian families. To follow Christ won't cause that disruption. Or others, you already know the hurts and pains of family breakdown and dysfunctional families, and it's hard to add to the problems. But actually, around the world, there'll be other loyalties and precious things that following Christ has cost people. Education, the chance to work. Even in this country, I know those whose jobs have had to go as work practice has crossed Christ's lordship. Now, following Christ, you see, is not a life accessory. Not how I feel Thursday lunchtime with the best lunch for £2.50 to follow. It's not an interest to log onto my CV. It's not to be played at. Jesus isn't looking for armchair supporters, but disciples. Now, you don't need a martyr complex. You do need to be clear about this. Being true to Jesus will involve the kind of radicalism that will set you at odds with the society around us. See how he goes on in verse 27? "Anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple." You want to be clubbable? You're determined to get on in the world? You can't bear sticking out like a sore thumb? You never want to rock the boat for fear of the consequences? Well, understand, you cannot be a Christian. You haven't done your sums, if you think you can. Can you afford to sign up? If you're just about to walk away, wait a moment, will you? Jesus hasn't finished. And nor have you if you want to get your sums right. Here's the second question we've got to face. Not can I afford to sign up, but can you afford to refuse? Can you afford to refuse? See, Jesus gives another for example, doesn't he, in that little passage. You saw it there in verse 33. We've moved from the builder to the king. Suppose a king's about to go to war against another king. Will he not first of all sit down and consider whether he's able with 10,000 men to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000? If he's not able, he'll send a delegation while the other's still a long way off and will ask for terms of peace. In the same way, any of you who doesn't give up everything he has cannot be my disciple. Now, won't you first sit down and consider whether you're able to win the war? You rather suspect the president of Georgia needed to hear that last month before his encounter with the Russian army, don't you? Someone hadn't done their sums properly there. And at first sight, this is just the same truth as the builder, only with soldiers rather than bricks. But look again, there is a difference. You see, for the builder, it was all theory when he sat down, wasn't it? It was just drawings and costings. He has a choice, you know, he can go ahead or he can do nothing. For the king, the king must do something. See, he's being invaded. Does he fight or does he sue for peace? But he must do one or the other. And for some of us, we face Christ more like the king than the builder. He just has got too close to us to ignore. You know, there is sometimes that experience of Christ sort of relentlessly pursuing, and someone here will know that. If you kind of can't go anywhere without bumping into someone who's another of those awkward Christians. Or you're reading a book and it's just a harmless novel, and then there's some paragraph in it that triggers Christ. It's an allusion in a film. It's a text on the tube. You're here this lunchtime and you can't quite work out why. Well, what are the peace terms then to get him off my back? Well, look at verse 33. Any of you who does not give up everything he has cannot be my disciple. Well, I couldn't possibly do that, you say. Well, then you can't be a Christian. Well, what happens if I fight? Well, you've got to sit down, haven't you? It was 10,000 against 20,000 if you were the king in the story. And the odds, let me tell you, are far worse if you want to take on Christ. See, he's the one who put the world together. He knows how it works. His values are not financial, but they're just as real. Contentment. The kind of peace that comes from having a life that actually fits what we were intended to be. He is the ultimate Lord. He will have the last word on each one of us. He is the Savior, the only one who can rescue me from my sins. I used to live out the East End, and I would cycle into the city every day past through Whitechapel and past a statue there to William Booth, the founder of the Salvation Army, that did such great work in so many practical ways for the poor of the East End. And I've never forgotten the story of William Booth. Later in life, he was bedding in a room with his son Bramwell, and it was the middle of the night, and he was tossing and turning on his bed, and his son says to him, Dad, shouldn't you be asleep? And he says, no, I'm thinking. I'm thinking about people's sins. What will they do with their sins? Now friends, that isn't just a question for London E1. It's just as big a question for London W1 as well. How can we afford to refuse Jesus? What will you do with your sins? Face to face with the Holy God. Hey, you must get your sums right. Well, can't I be a Christian any other way, you ask? And the answer is no. Anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Any of you who does not give up everything he has cannot be my disciple. Someone saying, look, who does he think he is to lay down these terms? Well, let me tell you. He's done his sums. He's done his cost-benefit analysis. He left family security and wealth. He did carry a cross to the full agony of execution. He's not asking anything of us he hasn't done himself. He's done his sums. He thought it was worth it. Now, to be strictly accurate, he thought you and I, were worth it. He did it for us, not for himself. If you want to know how Jesus does his sums, if you want to know how Jesus does his maths, well, as they say in every good soap, you'll have to look in next week. Thanks.